This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, John Emmerich, and today we're talking to Mary Childs, the author of the new book, The Bond King: How One Man Made a Market, Built an Empire, and Lost It All. Mary is a co-host of NPR's Planet Money podcast. Welcome, Mary, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you end up working as a journalist specifically within the financial world? What was the path?
Well, I started out kind of thinking I would be a political, you know, a politics reporter, and I tried it and I was horrible at it. I could not understand how scoops happened. Like, it seemed like just a person would tell you a thought that they had and that was a scoop if the person's important enough. So I just couldn't understand how you fact check that, it blew my mind. And in financial reporting, you have, you know, trades that you can look at. You have stock prices and, you know, lines that go up or down, and they don't really not do what they're saying. You know, it's like a lot less confusing and a lot easier to fact check. So I found that I just understood everything better in financial markets. I felt more secure in my own ability to fact check things and not be led astray. And it's fun. You know, everybody's always inventing new stuff, and it's complicated and it's fun to figure out, and it can be kind of elegant and it can be kind of funny. I just really appreciate the kind of the beauty of the structures in financial journalism. So, or in finance that I get to write about. So.
And I get the sense from reading the extra sections in the back of the book that you've been working on this particular book for a while.
Yes, that's correct. You get the right sense.
How long?
So Bill left PIMCO abruptly in September 2014, and I worked for about 3 months on trying to get, you know, the behind the scenes story, what really happened that in the moments leading up to that departure. And that was a very tough story to do because obviously at the time no one wanted to talk to me. So that took me about 3 months to really kind of crack it and get that story. And then by the time I had that, you know, it was some 2,000-3,000 word story at Bloomberg, which is incredibly long for, you know, my career to date. But there was so much that I hadn't put in. So I just felt at that point, and then when it published, it was met with such an enormous response. I felt like there was just a lot more to do. So I started working on it basically right then. It's been more or less since Bill left PIMCO.
And you tell the great Brownie story in the book. I'll let the readers uncover it themselves. You spoke to well over 200 people for this book, including mm-hmm. Bill Gross. Mm-hmm. So after the Brownie story, when did you first meet with him, and how is that relationship, and how has it been since you finished interviewing everyone for this book?
Yeah, so we actually had met well before the alleged Brownie incident. I covered credit markets before starting to cover PIMCO and some other asset managers while at Bloomberg News. So I had a lot of overlap with PIMCO in that way, but also had spoken directly to Bill. And I think the first time was in 2013, and then started covering PIMCO in April 2014 and had plenty of time then too to talk to him about, you know, oh, the new direction the firm is going in, the new structure, yada, yada. So I kind of arrived right in a really tumultuous period for PIMCO, which only became more tumultuous. But we talked throughout that, him as the face of the firm. It was obviously relevant for me as a beat reporter to get to talk to him. So, right. You know, he was super generous too. In 2017, we sat down for multiple days for many, many hours at a time talking about, you know, his life and his childhood and his view of the world and investing and all this. So he was very generous with his time and his thoughts. And then, you know, I went off to like write and research, and he was very responsive on email, and I would kind of do some, hey, is this right? Was it this motel in Vegas or that one? And then in 2021, my fact checker, you know, I had him on a Planet Money episode in February 2021 talking about a really big trade that he'd done that actually had turned out poorly, but he's, you know, game as ever. So he was happy to talk about it, and he's not the kind of person who's like, oh, that was an embarrassing moment for me. No, he's just like, that's a fact. Let's talk. Yeah, fine. And then in 2021, the summer, my fact checker sent a list of questions, which, you know, it's all the facts that were going to be in the book. So you can really see the kind of structure, the architecture of the book. And I think that he kind of looked at that and was like, this isn't what I wanted. This isn't my story, according to, you know, how I would tell it. And, you know, he's never been unkind to me about it. He's really always been pretty respectful and understanding of the news gathering and reporting process, which is actually invaluable. You know, he understands media, as you probably can observe from 40 odd years of having been on TV and in the press. But it is, you know, there are other people who have been on TV and in the press for just as long and who are terrible to deal with. So it's interesting to me that he just gets it and knows, like, and for the most part gives you the latitude to do your work. So anyway, he just wrote his own and he published it 2 weeks before my book came out. And yeah, it's interesting to see how they overlap and don't. They're different in many ways. But it is sort of an interesting exercise journalistically to have this kind of, you know, a source's own voice in full, you know, right alongside it. And you know, he's been pretty cool about it. So
that's a gem of a detail that I wasn't aware of. That just adds to the richness of an already rich story. And I going back to your introduction about how you got into finance, it's telling, because my next question was this book, it could be in business history, it could be in the finance section, the psychology section, because it's part of all three. And it's crazy how in this industry there is so much drama in what could just be mm-hmm. a rather, you know, mundane mathematical endeavor. But my instinct is to start with the last one, the psychology. We'll get into that, but a quick business history question for you. Gross starts his professional life, thanks to his mother, I think, as an analyst with Pacific Life. How does PIMCO get formed outside of Pacific Life, with Gross owning the big equity stake that would eventually make him so rich in the Alliance deal?
Yeah, so it is an interesting story that I think actually got super compressed in the book, where over the course of like the 1980s, they spun out in tiny little increments. It was very annoying to report, because I was like, wait, so you spun out in 83, but then again, wait, what? And it was just very hard to understand that kind of incremental. And that's just like a tweak to the compensation structure. You know, all of these things are just like, it's weird how the closer you get to the details, the more formless it appears, in a way where it's like, okay, you're still part of Pack Life, but you're not really, but you're sort of not a standalone, but you have this profit sharing agreement, which, you know, anyway. So it was this kind of constant renegotiation where Bill Podlick, the then CEO, and, you know, some of the other guys at PIMCO would go back to Pacific Mutual and be like, you know, then Pacific Mutual, and say, hey, we're generating all these profits. We're gonna, you know, we need some kind of compensation for it, and kind of bang the table and try to give a little show. And they flirted with the idea of going elsewhere, but it didn't really take off. They actually liked the structure, I think, at Pacific Mutual. And Pacific Mutual, to their credit, they were like, okay, yeah, we want you to stick around. You're generating a lot of money. You're probably going to keep doing it. So these structures kept getting kind of tweaked and tweaked as they demanded more and more kind of the profits and more ownership of what they were doing.
Got it. So it wasn't a singular event.
It was many, many times. Yeah. And then they did like a reverse merger in 94 and like went public. There were a lot of different iterations before the Allianz one. Yeah. And all of that, like, I spent so long on that reverse merger and I did nothing on it in the book. So I apologize to Bill Thompson.
No, give me something to ask. It's great. Now to the psychology piece. At the end of the book, you contemplate something I've often wondered about, which is, do people who end up rich and famous and powerful and exhibit eccentric behavior, or to your point, sometimes excessively petty behavior? Were they always weird, or did the money and fame make them weird? In this story, in regards to Gross, there's this fascinating, to me, red flag up front, which is this overriding desire to be famous above all the other options. When does that motivation happen? When is it, does it last his whole career? Why is it the most important thing to him? And if that, if you can, how does it relate back to his pettiness and eccentric behavior?
I think, you know, it was there throughout his career. I think it stemmed back from his childhood, is what he would tell you, where he had, you know, cold Canadian parents who didn't hug him enough. And he felt, you know, he felt like he had this kind of chasm or this hole in his heart where, and I'm projecting a little bit, you know, he's never said hole in his heart, but Absolutely. He did say that he, you know, seemed to equate fame with love, that if he could be famous and be this big person on stage, that in some way, you know, he knew rationally that this made no sense, but in emotionally, he seemed to seek out fame as a way, as a proxy for love. And I think you see that coming out in, you know, his pettiness. He had this kind of, I don't want to say at all costs, because that sort of belies his ability to weigh risk, right?
Right.
But to some extent, there is that disconnect between head and heart with Bill, as one of his former colleagues just put it to me. And I think that that's really true, where rationally he knows that this isn't going to help him, that, you know, whatever petty behavior he's about to undertake is not going to be good for him, is not what he actually wants, but he does it anyway. Right. And I think, first of all, I find that so resonant, because, like, who among us? Like, I certainly have instances where I'm like, oh, you think, you know, you're going to, like, cut me in the grocery line or whatever extremely mundane thing. But it's not interesting or exciting when it's me, you know, because I'm not a billionaire. But if it's him, he has the means to kind of wage war against whoever has wronged him and make it really miserable for them. So that, to your point, I think is, like, that's to some extent a revealed preference. That's a difference between our means and our abilities, where I'm not going to, you know, be able to exact a whole lot of revenge on my enemies.
Right.
Like, I might be, like, kind of rude, but that's pretty much the extent of it. And Bill just has much, much more capacity and much more, just so many resources at his disposal. So I think, and to another point too, is that there is a psychological change. And I'm not sure the extent to which this is true for Bill Gross. I certainly couldn't say. But for all, you know, the studies show that, you know, when you reach a certain level of wealth and, you know, power and whatever, that your brain does change, your decision-making changes, you become less empathetic. So it's possible that some of that comes to bear, where he just, you know, after so long of being so rich and famous, the way you interact with people changes. I'm not sure how that shows up in his life, but I do think that those underlying motivations were definitely there from the get-go.
Got it. And maybe it's just one of those things where you have that recessed gene in you, and then the opportunity comes out and you exercise it. Yeah.
Right. Like, am I going to be terrible to that person in the grocery store line when I'm a billionaire? Like, let's find out. Let's revisit.
Right. And so he exacts his revenge. He can act cruelly. And you talk about the world he built was cruel, petty, and filled with boys pulling wings off flies, which is just such a wonderful line. But he could also do it publicly. So let's talk about his investment outlooks, which I remember from back in the day. I worked with another portfolio manager in my career that was sure he was the next James Grant, going so far as to adopting the bow tie look at one point.
Wow.
And the outlooks come up throughout your book without you expressing a personal view about them one way or the other until, like, the last quarter of the book, when he writes about his dead cat, Bob, and then again in reference to his first outlook of when you arrived at Janus. The word you use is bizarre. And they were bizarre to me at the time, too. I remember getting them shared around the investment community. Did he think he was a great writer? What was he trying to achieve with these, you know, parable and metaphor-rich investment letters? I'm assuming he thought everyone was really waiting to hear, you know, quarterly or monthly what he had to say. What's your take on that dynamic of those outlooks?
I think that's right. Like, he was waiting. He did have the impression that everyone was waiting to hear from him, but I should note that it was true, that that's true and accurate. People were hanging on these monthly outlooks. You know, they were read across the street. And like, to some extent, of course, I'm biased. I you know, stay in the credit world. That's like the space that I grew up in, you know, as a journalist. And it's kind of a space that I like to stay in just because I love it and find it interesting. But so of course, there's some bias there where like, I'm like, everybody's reading it. It's like, okay, my, you know, bond people are reading it for sure. But I do think, it crossed over into other asset classes. And I do think that it was part of his celebrity. I think that it helped to build this, you know, these bizarro anecdotes that were, you know, confessional, and everything that's ever happened to Bill Gross. You know, you can really paint a good mosaic of his life just from his own writing, which was a boon to me, right? Like as a person writing a book about this guy, I had so much to mine, so much kind of personal content, which was very helpful from him. But it also, you know, I don't think everybody was doing that when he started out. I don't think people really do it today, even where they, you know, he had this position of influence in the market, but he also was basically like client, like retail focused, like mainstream focused with this investment outlook output, where people could turn to him and say, oh my gosh, well, this genius Bill Gross guy, he thinks that interest rates are doing this or that. And I think that that was a big part. You know, the weird anecdotes get you in the door. And now you're reading, and then you're going to hear about his, you know, interest rate call. And I think that that was actually quite sticky. I think people really liked those, and it helped to build and cultivate and retain this kind of fan base that also translated to an investor base, you know?
Business. Yep. Okay. he's not the only character in this book. Ellerian is a character in his own right. The footnotes from his lawyers throughout the book were additional entertainment for me. I enjoyed those thoroughly.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, you're right of Gross's view. He saw only Ellerian's hollow insistence on FaceTime in the office, his breezy economic doublespeak, words that slip through your hands like rushing water, how he managed to talk so much without saying anything. Is there anything to that view, in your opinion?
I think, oh gosh, that's a tough question. Sometimes I think Mohamed Ellerian might be talking over my head, you know, like maybe he's hitting on some macroeconomic theory that I haven't gone to grad school to understand. But at the same time, there are moments where he does have a gift for clearly stating like consensus, like what the macro vibe is. And I think that that is really annoying for Bill Gross. You know, I don't have any skin in the game here, so it's not annoying for me. But I do think that, like, if you're saying, oh, you know, the economy is coming to a T junction, it could go one way or it could go the other way, Bill Gross is going to be like, what? What?
Right. Take a stand. Yeah.
Right. Like, where is it going to go? Like, do the next thing. So I think that to me is like, you know, he's an economist, and a lot of that job is not, you know, making those calls. There's an actual friction. You know, he was an investor, so that's, I don't mean to discount that, but there is that, like, just a formational or like structural difference between being an investor and being an economist.
Yeah. I liked your comment about the dealing with consensus. I started following on Twitter just recently, and within a week I came up with a term called copy paste journalism, you know, just kind of regurgitating. The guy's got, you know, he's a brilliant guy in all regards. He's definitely at a minimum a master of corporate politics and survival and public image, but he's got to have enormous other gifts. But I just, after a while, I actually said to my phone, while the Twitter account was open, you know, so what's the trade? You know, what are you recommending we do with the headline inflation interest rate numbers that we all got at the same time, you know? But I'll get off that. You talked about the communication to their investors being bond investors versus the stock market. Bill Gross, for years, felt the need to pontificate about the stock market, something that Gundlach does today. In fact, there was an ominous headline this morning with his picture on the front saying calamity may be coming. It's always around the corner, but is it a transparent attempt to kind of talk their book, talk about bonds as superior alternatives to stocks, or is there another motive, another just, you know, enjoying the attention and being read just like, you know, Elon Musk tweets all day. Why were those guys always talking about the stock market?
I think it is a good way to build your base. You know, I think it does seem to be more effective and more like retail investors invest so much less in bonds and certainly don't day trade them really, you know? So I think that's a big difference, where if I'm day trading in the stock market and I see this guy on CNBC saying stuff that's relevant to me, I'm going to be so much more interested than if he's like, oh, I think the yield on the 30-year bond, I'm out. That's not going to help me at all.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that that's definitely a part of it is the ability to appeal to retail investors and people who are, you know, thinking about what to do with their money, but also want someone to listen to. And it has this kind of not that that marketing benefit really does end up having a business building effect.
One more borderline psychology question. There is, as you say, with Bill, his focus on legacy and pride, which is not unique, and some selective memory and this special relationship with the truth. Neither of us, as we've just talked about, is a mental health expert. Let's disclose that up front. But do you buy his Asperger's self-diagnosis, or is this really just pretty standard kind of narcissistic personality disorder, this relationship with the truth and selective memory? I don't mean that in a condescending way. I've dealt with people like that before in this profession, and doesn't make them bad people, but it does affect how you deal with them.
Yeah, I think you've hit on something where there's a lot of conflating, you know, autism spectrum with being a jerk. And that's not right. That's not appropriate. Like, those things are distinct, and that's not cool to conflate them. And I'm not saying Bill necessarily was like, I was a jerk because of it, you know, but I do think that there is, and across financial markets, I remember when The Big Short came out, everybody was reading it and everybody was going through that Michael Burry checklist being like, oh my God, me too. And that's indeed how Bill Gross basically came to the realization that he might, you know, be on the spectrum and ended up getting, as you say, this diagnosis. So given that he got a diagnosis, I'm certainly not going to argue with that. That's, you know, seems like someone who knows better than me has weighed in. So I'm going to just let that be. But I do think that it causes, you know, the manifestations of that are going to be things that aren't, you know, mainstream corporate culture stuff. So I do think that sets people up for some friction where, you know, if Bill Gross is coming to the office and he wants to exist in a way that's, you know, comfortable for him, which means, you know, no eye contact and letting him focus and all this stuff, you know, people super, you know, gregarious, like hyper extrovert, not neurodivergent, you know, totally neurotypical people are going to be like, hey, Bill, how's it going? And, you know, slap him on the back. And that's just like devastating. Right. You know, that's just so disruptive and annoying. So I think, yes, like those things are separate and distinct, and they are not at all, like, there's not really an overlap between being an asshole and, can I curse? I just went for it.
Yeah. I'm surprised you beat me to it. Go ahead.
So, you know, a diagnosis is not a free, you know, a blank check to be a jerk. But I do think that it does mean that you're going to interact with people differently. And sometimes people aren't equipped for that or are prepared for that or willing to work around that and or with that. And I think that, like, that's a commentary on our corporate culture and PIMCO's corporate culture. And I do think that, you know, it does add a layer, right, of making him make a little bit more sense. I think that, you know, some people have told me they'll be reading and they're like, this guy sounds a little like maybe he sounds, you know, and then by the they get to the end and they're like, oh, he's diagnosed. I felt that. So I'm happy that that feeling exists and it isn't like, you know, you're not surprised by the diagnosis in the end, because I don't think it's a surprise. I don't think it's, you know, not being any kind of professional, it does sound correct. It does seem like something that might be relevant to him and his life.
Sure.
And yeah, so.
Okay. And now we wander into the finance section of the bookstore.
All right.
Let's talk about the great financial crisis. Right up front, page four, you talk about companies and financial institutions being bailed out. And this is something I've thought a lot about since it happened. And at the time, I've never been able to find the clip, but for me, what is one of the more compelling pieces of financial news video, if there's such a thing, is this debate that went on between Bill Ackman of Gotham and Bill Gross about Fannie Mae. And as I recall it, Ackman's in the CNB studio, Gross is video conferenced in, and they're debating the value of Fannie Mae debt. Ackman does this indisputable finance 101 analysis.
Right.
You know, it's you've got $100 of debt, the enterprise value is worth $75, therefore, they got to write off the debt. They debate briefly. Gross cuts him off and says, I get paid to be right on the trade, and I'm going to be right on the trade, which he very much was, you know. So this is a really big event almost in financial history. He was involved in so many things, but this one was, what was his role in the Fannie Mae government bailout as it happened? And was it a gamble? Was it a gamble initially, or did some point, as I the vibe I got from that interview, that at some point he knew he was right?
I mean, I think I have such a hard time parsing, like, when you're talking your book and when you're not. Like, you're talking your book because it's your book and you believe in it. So you're not just, there's always kind of an interaction there between what you actually believe and what you're just trying to say to make money. Those things are oftentimes the same. Like there's a lot of overlap between those things. So okay. That's a little confusing to me, first of all, just something I observe a lot and something I think about a lot. But in this case, you know, Bill Gross and PIMCO were truly at the epicenter of the mortgage market and had been for so long. And this crisis emanated from the mortgage market. So more than anyone, I think they were equipped to see what was happening, equipped to understand it, and equipped to understand what had to happen next. So, and you know, they were so influential too in the market that I think when the US government was looking around trying to figure out what to do, and Bill Gross and PIMCO are out there saying, hey, you're going to have to go ahead and make that promise explicit. You're going to have to go ahead and back Fannie and Freddie. You know, they guaranteed directly or indirectly some $5 trillion of mortgage debt at that time. And that's a boatload, especially when so much of that is about to be written down substantially
underwater.
Or has to be, right? Yeah. Exactly. So underwater. So I think that's the, you know, there's this weird interplay between the government and PIMCO and these enormous bond managers where the government more or less has to listen to them and has to say, okay, if they're, you know, if Fannie and Freddie have to roll new debt, if they have to finance themselves in the market where PIMCO is an enormous player and buyer, are they going to not listen? Are they going to just not, like, they really are in a position where they have to kind of at least take into very, very good consideration what PIMCO has to say. So in this instance, you know, to me, this is the moment where PIMCO's at the kind of height of their power, where the government's trying to figure out what to do. And Bill Gross and PIMCO, others at PIMCO, are very public saying, you're going to have to make this explicit. You have to back Fannie and Freddie. And then they do it.
Right.
And it was an enormous day for PIMCO Total Return. I think the best day the fund had ever had to that
Huge.
Point.
Yeah. And
you haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
It's fascinating to me as a former equity person. You know, the insider trading laws in equities are pretty straightforward. And although, you know, people try to make a living skirting around the edges, they are what they are. What is the equivalent in the bond market besides this Fannie Mae deal, the Ginnie Mae trade, cornering nines, odd lots? They seem to be able to do a lot of profitable transactions for which there is no legal equivalent, I don't think, in the stock market. And it is amazing to me how, as you said, that there are times when they were the market, you know, and it was so profitable. But what are trading laws? I said insider trading laws, but like in the bond market, there's so many different segments, corporate treasuries and mortgage backs. How are they, how do they compare?
I feel like not great. It's my sense, and I'm not a regulator, but it's my sense that the regulations are pretty ill-fitting and that, you know, there's this, they're kind of behind the curve on in the bond market trying to figure out how to regulate it, and that the regulations they do have just don't sit that well on the actual actions. You know, there's just a mismatch between how people behave and how things actually interact. So with the, and how they try to regulate things. And part of that is just that's life, you know, like it's always going to be a little gnarly and hairier in real life than it actually should be in this beautiful theoretical land of regulatory. And you have to kind of ascribe intent at some time. Anyway, so I do think there's some structural, like natural tension there. But also, I don't know. I think for a long time they weren't as focused on it and they weren't chasing it as hard. And you see that where they're just kind of trying to play catch up and asking questions about, hey, is this how you value this security? Hey, and then how does this one trade? And it's kind of basic stuff, you know, according to my sources, who can be a little condescending sometimes. So, so take with salt.
Yeah.
But, you know, like that's a little, and you see that with, okay, I also covered earlier in my career, like the London Whale. And there was moment where, yeah, it was so fun, where, you know, he was within the, he was marking things within the bid ask, but maybe a little bit on one side. And it, there was this confusion over, wait, can you get in trouble if you're still within the bid ask? Like, like, is that not okay? If I went in the bid ask spread, I should be fine. Like that's literally the like lanes of where I can play, right? But there's this kind of contradiction. And like the odd lots thing that you referenced that PIMCO did,
yeah,
it was this basically in super simple terms, buying these kind of like decayed, gnarly little bundles of securities and plopping them into a pricing mechanism that didn't account for the gnarliness and the fact that they were underloved in the market as a result of that kind of, you know, decay and gnarliness. And they would get marked up to the whole lot price, to the price for the like beautiful 100% of all the securities are still there, not, you know, 54% or whatever it may be. And, you know, these things that there's an obvious price difference because they're, you know, maybe there are fewer securities that are going to contribute to a revenue stream, but also people don't feel like dealing with these things. So they traded a discount to even that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that wasn't really like, is that illegal? It's not their fault that the pricing system, you know, marks these a little bit wrong. Did they take full advantage of that? Yeah, it does look that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that is indeed the conclusion that the SEC came to. But yeah, so it's one of those moments where you're like, when that story came out, I remember everyone being like, oh my God, wait, what does that mean for my odd lots? Am I not allowed to buy odd lots now if they get rounded up? Mm. And the answer is like, no, you can if you're not trying to base an investment strategy and like kind of boost your the you know, performance, the look of your performance by using these, by over reliance on these things. So there's a lot of nuance there that I think is impossible to codify and really truly write out into whatever rule. You can't just be like, well, it depends on what you meant when you said it, right?
Right.
And I think that that can be hard to do. And there's a lot, you know, you asked about the kind of insider trading e-things in the bond market, and there's a lot of material non-public information, or, you know, I think that there's a lot of weirdness in distressed debt land where your own actions can become influential in the company, you know, your plan leaks out and that's non-public information that can affect the trajectory and the, you know, the price of the company's securities. Or, you know, you meet with the CFO who's telling you the, basically the debt schedule, the funding schedule that the company will have. And that's normal and fine. That's not a problem, but right. It is kind of, you know, a look that other people might not get, that I'm certainly not getting, you know, in my home office. So not yet, you know, but also I think, there are completely acceptable ways, like anchoring new issues in the bond market where, you know, when a new company debenture is coming out and people, underwriters want to find somebody to buy a huge slug of that debt so that everybody else wants to buy it, they call PIMCO. They call PIMCO and they call BlackRock. And those new issues, way, 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 way more often than not, pop as soon as they're issued. So you're going to almost get a guaranteed little return just by virtue of being big and being the first port of call.
Yeah. And they provide liquidity and in that regard, and that's worth something. So you talk, you, as you said, with the odd lots users, there's ways you can do it and ways you shouldn't do it. Cross trades are another tactic that can be structured legally.
Yeah.
1787s come up a lot in the book. How were they using them? And as time has passed, has that passed muster in hindsight?
So 1787 is an exemption in the 40 Act that basically allows you to trade within funds between, you know, if they're all kind of under the same umbrella and the same fund family. And that means, you know, if I'm running a fund and it's, you know, the really nice income fund, wait, I shouldn't say income because that's Dan's, excuse me, the really nice money fund, and I get hit with a ton of redemption requests, but I like all the bonds that I hold. I really want to raise cash, but I don't want to necessarily get rid of those bonds. They're good bonds. I bought them on purpose. I picked them, right? And there's a world in which I can sell it to my neighbor over here in the same fund family, to, you know, Bill Gross or to Dan Iverson or to whomever, because they're good bonds and we want to keep them. We want to keep them in-house and I don't feel like releasing them back into the street for no reason. You know, the my redemption requests are totally random and have nothing to do with, like, you know, the beautiful bonds that I have in my portfolio. So I can save those bonds and raise cash by selling them to my compatriot over here and, you know, not have to take them to the open market and get dinged and have people front run me and give me, you know, bad prices for no reason. So it kind of helps to buffer, I think, this kind of this potential deleterious effect of redemption requests. And, you know, I think that's a little controversial because the way that I put it is not how they want to think of it. But I do think that PIMCO 1787 more liberally than their peers. And I think that that's, you know, from everyone that I've talked to in the market within PIMCO and without, they're like, oh, yeah, no, like the way PIMCO uses it is way more liberal, way more enthusiastic than, and there are other firms that are like, oh, we, excuse you, we don't do that. You know, like, give me this look. Like, I just asked if they like do murder on the weekends. They're just like, why would you even suggest this? So there's, and I don't know, you know, the SEC, I think regulators were looking at this more recently. So I'm sure there's been some kind of, you know, polishing and scrubbing going on. Cause there were, you know, letters about how this is, you know, very important for us to be able to function. And, you know, I think they do use it for, you know, not only for not having a fire sale if they don't want to, but also, or at least buffering the impact of that fire sale, whatever selling needs to happen, but also, you know, flipping stuff into new funds, right? Transferring securities into a new fund that's just launched, or shuffling. There are reasons why you would want to shuffle things around that are not just because, oh, this, you know, enormous redemption request has come in and we need to figure out what to do. So yeah, I don't know. I think that I think the SEC is paying attention and is looking at this sort of like now-ish. So I'd be curious to hear. I don't know the impact of that. I'm not sure like how we'll that's changed. Out. Exactly. I'm excited to find out. You know, it is my favorite thing and I'm so glad that you asked about it. But I feel like no one ever asked about 1787.
Really? Oh yeah. I'm a board member, so I kinda, you know, I get updated by fund counsel on, you know, what the SEC is looking at. And so it's part of my job, but I admit I nerd out on it a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And,
no, it's good.
That was an interesting one. We'll end up back at the business history section of the store. I had no idea Gross had entertained a move to Double Line upon leaving PIMCO deciding on Janus. What was the deciding factor in his choosing Janus, an equity shop, over Double Line, if you know it?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple things at play here, where Jeffrey Gundlach is obviously this enormous personality, this enormous celebrity in the bond market too, and has to some extent, you know, taken the bond king crown, though he says he doesn't, you know, want that title at all.
Right.
And that structurally, you can imagine just knowing only those things would create a really awkward situation if Bill Gross were to come work at Double Line. Like, you can just imagine those enormous personalities not getting along. And Bill had just had this experience. He was in the thick of this experience in 2014, where he's being kind of bonked around and people are not respecting him enough and not like supporting him in the public eye and not doing all of these things. And you can only imagine that going from a place where he has been king for so long and has been the boss to a place where he's not even the main guy, like, that's not going to cure the problems that he has. That's not going to fix anything. But he remembered, you know, he talked to Dick Weil that summer.
Mm-hmm.
Or earlier in the year when when things were getting a little weird at PIMCO and he just wanted to have a backup. And Dick Weil had worked at PIMCO for many years. He was, you know, this very polished executive. He was the COO. He worked closely with the CEO. And, you know, people didn't necessarily think that Bill Gross and Dick Weil got along by any stretch. People kind of thought that Bill was a little mean to Dick. But when Dick Weil was running Janus, you know, the no hard feelings, Bill Gross just gave him a call and was like, would you have room? You know, is there a spot for me? And of course, right, Dick is like, this is an enormous opportunity for us. Yes, of course, we have a spot for you, Bill Gross. And I think it did what he wanted, really, is it brought all this attention to Janus. It brought money in and it made, you know, put them in the headlines. He told me once that that Bill Gross was their Peyton Manning, a game changing level of talent for them. And I mean, I think that, you know, he is a celebrity and people really care. So I think to some extent it just was a good match where it achieved some of Dick Weil's goals and it definitely achieved some of Bill's goals because he just wanted a fund and he wanted to be able to keep trading in the market and it allowed him to do that.
Right. And what a great Denver centric reference for Janus to come up with at the time, Peyton Manning. Bill Gross's personal story drifts from bizarre to sad at the end of the book, especially in his public interactions with his son and his ex-wife, Sue. His role in that divorce, reading like a retreating army, leaving devastation in its wake, is a whole new level of bizarre. But that's for the readers to check out and understand. Mary, besides nonstop interviews for this book, where else can listeners find you and your work?
I am at Planet Money. I'm a co-host, and we are, you know, a twice weekly podcast on NPR. And I'm on Twitter at MDC and, you know, LinkedIn and Instagram and all that. I do want to say, though, I just looked it up. It looks like the SEC has abandoned rewriting the Rule 1787.
Huh.
I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that yet, but let me Google it. But I do. That is interesting. There's like a new the commission has issued a joint statement in 2021.
Is it the news again?
Yeah, that everybody freaked out or that they were like trying to reform it. They're like, no. Yeah, okay, it was at the end of the year. So they're just not going to fix a problem of which they're not aware. I love it.
Got it.
They abandoned the much needed effort to amend it. Wow. Cool. Sorry.
That's okay.
I was like Googling just to be like, what even has happened since I last looked?
Right.
So it looks like they gave up.
They'll do that. Yeah. Until another SEC head decides to change direction.
Right.
Okay.
But it needs tackling.
The bond king, Bill Gross, invented the bond trading market, and PIMCO would make legendary contributions to the investing lexicon, like the new normal and the shadow banking system. But the journey from dead cats to dancing was anything but smooth. The book is a hole-in-one, Mary, and I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Thank you so much. That means so much to me. This was really fun.